WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. President Bush visited Singapore during his just-concluded trip to Asia and the Pacific Rim. Unlike our trade relations with Japan, American business relations with Singapore are now strong. If you don't keep up with this part of the world, you may be surprised to hear that over the past 30 years, Singapore has transformed itself from a country of widespread poverty to great affluence. But it's probably not the kind of economic miracle you'd want to participate in unless you enjoy living under authoritarian control. My guest Stan Sesser writes about Singapore in the current edition of The New Yorker magazine. His research included an interview with Lee Kuan Yew, who has presided over the country since it gained independence in 1959. When Lee stepped down as prime minister in 1990, he took the position of senior minister. This nation has been called Singapore Inc. because its style of government is so much like that of a corporation. But others call the Singapore style neo-authoritarianism, a term I asked Sesser to explain.
This is a new trend that you see happening all over Asia, where the hardline communist countries are looking for a way to survive. Their futures are threatened, and they look at their economies and they say, well, let's free up our economy like Singapore did, and we can continue to repress the people, and as long as they're making money, they won't mind it as much. China has done this, and the word neo-authoritarianism was, in fact, was first used by Chinese think tank scholars. And Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos have all been looking at the Singaporean model. I think it holds considerable appeal to Taiwan and South Korea also, who have had to free up their own governments to some extent. But now they're all suddenly realizing that if you free the economy and people are making a lot of money, they seem to be a lot happier despite a repressive government.
So it's a combination of communist-style authoritarianism with capitalistic free economy?
Exactly. The problem is that this has been successful in Singapore only because the government has totally rejected any notion of corruption. If you take literally one Singaporean dollar as a Christmas gift, you go to jail. Now, when Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, which are riddled with corruption, look at the Singaporean model and say, what a neat idea, we just free up our economy and everyone will be happy and we can continue to be repressive. And then they look at the absence of corruption in Singapore, their ardor for the whole idea might cool. It's absolutely essential that people not resent their government for the office holders getting rich at the expense of the people while they're engaging in this process. And whether this can happen elsewhere on the Singaporean model is the real question.
Well, you say that there's no better example than Singapore of a country that's gone from poverty to riches through good economic management. Let's look a little bit about what's responsible for the economic growth. You say that although Lee, the former head of Singapore, was anti-colonial, he really courted all the multinationals.
He brought the multinationals there, but unlike the rest of the world, he controlled the multinationals. No one controls Lee Kuan Yew. He controls everyone. So, for instance, the multinationals came in, and even when Singapore was impoverished in the early 60s, he insisted from the very first plant that environmental controls were in place. But he freed up everything else and made it so comfortable for them, they didn't mind putting scrubbers in the smokestacks.
And what was in it for Singapore to have the multinationals based there?
Well, Singapore lacked investment capital. That was the big problem. Who was going to put money into a country whose future was so uncertain? The thought in the West was that Singapore would fall to communism by the mid-60s, that it couldn't survive as a small little island state. And it was not a climate that investors would tend to rush in for, and he desperately needed investment capital. And here were the multinationals available with billions and billions of dollars to build all these plants and start producing products and provide employment, and all they needed was the right investment climate, and Lee provided that, and they provided the capital, which Singapore so desperately needed.
Now, you say that Li was able to drive out low-wage industries like textiles and shoes and bring in the new electronic industries, including computers and computer software. How did he do that?
Well, Singapore started in the 1960s. The only foothold they could get in the industrial world was offering cheap labor to build products textiles and other products. And after a while, Singapore was so successful with this that Li tried a second strategy, and this was to lure high-tech industries, which would provide much better wages and make Singapore much more prosperous. So he arbitrarily decreed. Now, Singapore is, you talk about a free market capitalist country, but this is a free market capitalist country with a difference. All economic decisions are made by the government. It just so happens that they make wise decisions as opposed to the rest of the world. When governments interfere in economies, they make generally bad decisions. But Singapore arbitrarily ordered wages pushed up, and they told high-tech companies, set up shop here and we'll do everything. And in cases when an entrepreneur wanted to come into Singapore with a high-tech product that was so risky, so much for the future, that the company didn't have enough money, the government of Singapore itself gave the company money to come in and establish a plant. And it was a hugely successful strategy.
What are some of the American companies that have bases in Singapore now?
Oh, all the leading computer companies, IBM, Seagate Technology, Apple, all the leading computer companies have manufacturing facilities of one sort or another in Singapore. Mobil Oil is very big. They have a big oil refining facility. General Electric is very big. There are shipbuilding companies, banks. There are probably 700-800 U.S. companies with operations in Singapore now.
And what's in it for them to locate to Singapore or to have, you know, to set up some branches in Singapore?
It's a wonderful deal for them because they get the infrastructure of the United States, even better than the United States. Telephones that work, offices that are wonderfully efficient, terrific secretarial help. Your office can run at a level of efficiency probably seen nowhere else in the world, even in the United States. And by the standards of Southeast Asia, it's just remarkable to see this, what can get accomplished in one day in Singapore. So if you're basing your Southeast Asian operations in Singapore as opposed to Bangkok, where you can't even drive anywhere because the whole city is snarled in an endless traffic jam. If you're basing your operations in Singapore, you can take advantage of this wonderful infrastructure to get all these things accomplished. It's a great thing for them.
And everybody speaks English.
And everyone speaks English, right.
Okay, so Singapore has managed to create this incredibly prosperous economy with new high-tech industry. But there isn't a whole lot of freedom for the people who live there. There's a lot of human rights violations, censorship, homosexuality is against the law.
Punishable by up to life imprisonment.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been some people sentenced to life imprisonment for homosexual acts.
You see, now that they're thinking of government incentives to have college graduates marry and breed together so that they're creating a better breed of baby in Singapore.
Well, the government wants to control everything and wants to do everything its way, and to hell with what the rest of the world thinks. Eugenics after Adolf Hitler is not a very popular concept, but this doesn't matter to Singapore, and Lee Kuan Yew is upset. What happens in Singapore is that the men in Singapore, the training is all oriented toward technology, and the young Singaporean Chinese men, the vast majority of the population are Chinese, are a bunch of computer nerds, and they have never laid eyes on a woman and wouldn't know how to take a woman out to dinner or what to do. And the women in Singapore who have now complete freedom to get a university education have university degrees, and the men don't want them. The men want housewives to raise their children. So the women don't get married. Up to half the young university graduate women in Singapore are single. And the government's very upset about this. So they provide incentives to marry and breed.
So it just seems like such a paradoxical culture under this neo-authoritarianism, where on the one hand you have this prospering economy, people are making money, most people own their own homes. On the other hand, they have very little in the way of personal freedom. Does the government think that by having people be economically prosperous, that will prevent any kind of attack on the government or any kind of revolution against it?
The government definitely thinks that, and it certainly will. Singapore is a country where 85% of the people in Singapore own their own apartments, probably the highest rate of home ownership in the world, and the apartment values are going up hugely, so everyone has an economic stake in the system. And to give up that stake to see uncensored movies or read books that the government might not like them to read, well, that doesn't interest people enough. If they want to see an uncensored movie, they go over to Malaysia, buy a videotape of that movie, and smuggle it back into Singapore. But the thing they don't do is demand freedom. You don't demand freedom in Singapore, or you're in trouble.
The United States is, you know, looking at the Pacific Rim, wondering why so many countries have been prosperous there and what could we learn from their economic prosperity. Are there any lessons for the United States watching an authoritarian government's prosperity? Is there anything we could take away from that?
There actually is a big lesson from Singapore, and that lesson is that government intervention in the economy can be a very important element in getting the economy to take off. In Singapore, government intervention has been all positive. You get companies to take risks. If they're unwilling to supply the capital, the government steps in and supplies the capital itself and joins the company as a partner. You're always encouraging risk-taking. You're always encouraging new exports. In the United States, government intervention seems to be to aid bankers and savings and loan executives and insurance company executives to aid them in the process of looting their companies at the expense of the people. And today we see a trend in the United States that companies are restructuring. IBM lays off 20,000 people. General Electric lays off 10,000 people, whatever. And this is supposed to reinvigorate our economy by laying off people in every industry. Well, in Singapore, this would never happen. People don't get laid off in Singapore. There's full employment. And what happens is you create new products for these people to make. You take risks, and the government encourages risk-taking when it's too much of a financial gamble for the individual company, and that's a lesson we could well learn.
Do you think that there's any way for a country to have the kind of tight economic planning of a place like Singapore without having the authoritarian control over the people who live in the country?
I don't see what tight control over the economy has to do with telling people what books they can and cannot read and what movies they can and cannot watch. The people in Singapore have minds. They're intelligent people. They're well-traveled. They can't be isolated from the rest of the world. I don't see what good it does. I don't see how... I think the government is so paranoid that it feels that any degree of freedom, that people will just seize upon this and tear apart the society. But they're not going to tear apart their own economic interests. So I don't see the relation between the two.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he has a piece in the current issue of The New Yorker about Singapore. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Stan Sesser is my guest, and we're discussing Singapore, which is the subject of his current piece in The New Yorker magazine. Well, just a few days ago, President Bush became the first American president to visit Singapore. Why was he the first? Why hadn't other American presidents been there?
Well, the relationship between the United States and Singapore has always been slightly tenuous. Although American companies are the leading investors in Singapore, the CIA in 1960 got off to a very bad start when Singapore achieved its independence. The CIA assumed that Lee Kuan Yew was a communist, and they tried to put on the CIA's payroll the head of Singapore's intelligence agency. Lee Kuan Yew found out about it, and then a very high American official came to Singapore and offered Lee Kuan Yew a bribe of $3.3 million if he would keep the affair quiet. Lee Kuan Yew instead rejected the bribe and asked for $33 million in foreign aid for Singapore, and the United States just laughed at that. And that's how relations between newly independent Singapore and the United States started. And Singapore has always resented the idea of the United States lecturing Singapore about human rights and these other so-called Western things, which Singapore feels has no meaning for an Asian society. There's always been resentment against the United States, even though they've been economic allies.
I think the new development that came out of President Bush's visit to Singapore was a tentative agreement to expand military cooperation between the two countries. What do you think is going to come out of that?
Well, this is what Lee Kuan Yew has wanted for years. He wants the United States to protect Singapore, to establish a base in Singapore, and therefore to say to Singapore's Muslim neighbors, you better watch it. You can't pounce upon these Chinese the way you may have wanted to 10 or 20 years ago. Now we've got the United States on our side. This is exactly what Singapore has always wanted, and I think the military relationship between the two countries can only continue to expand. As the United States moves out of the Philippines, they'll be moving more into Singapore, and Singapore will provide them with a base of operations in Southeast Asia. It's so mutually advantageous to the two countries that it has to expand from its current situation.
Now, President Bush has decided not to make an issue of human rights violations for now in Singapore. Would you advise the president to say something about human rights violations in Singapore?
I think the United States has an obligation, particularly in Southeast Asia. When we look at the situation all over Southeast Asia, and so much of the repression of human rights in Southeast Asia is due to the outgrowth of American policies stemming from the Vietnam War and our efforts to contain communism at all cost. We've left behind such a legacy of fascism in Southeast Asia that I think we have an obligation there beyond any place in the world to push a human rights agenda, not only in Singapore, but in Indonesia, Malaysia, in Thailand with the year-old military dictatorship, all over Southeast Asia. I think it's absolutely fundamental that we push a human rights agenda in that part of the world.
What do you think the chances of that happening are?
Zero. We're fine when it comes to a country like Burma, where we have no economic interests and where there are repeated human rights violations. Then we're free to take a very strong human rights stand. But I think the history of American foreign policy is that human rights has never been the number one preoccupation. It's always been number two to economic interests. And our economic interests are too strong in Singapore, as they are in Thailand also, I think in the eyes of American policymakers, to imperil that at all with any kind of human rights agenda.
What's it like to be a reporter in Singapore? And after all, you interviewed the heads of state. These are the people who have created these tough censorship laws in the country.
Well, it was a very strange experience for me to be in a country that is so prosperous and so westernized on the surface, and yet underneath is so repressive, and to talk to people who are people like anyone you'd encounter in intellectual circles in the United States, and yet find them so fearful about their life, and so unwilling to say anything to me unless it were done in absolute secrecy. In one case, I got an interview only because I beat my answering machine in Berkeley. And I was in my Singapore hotel room dialing my answering machine. There was a message on my answering machine giving me a number in Singapore to call and say, don't identify yourself, don't do anything. When the person answers, just say, I want to make an appointment for lunch. And I followed those instructions, and we ended up at a restaurant, and I met this person who was an establishment journalist, and he thought that Singapore was Nazi Germany. I just could not believe how paranoid he was about Singapore. But to have these sorts of meetings, you'd expect in places where you had the military patrolling the streets and shooting people, and to get this in a prosperous Western country was really a surprise. It was very, very interesting place to be, very interesting if you get beneath the surface of all the Western-style shopping malls and boutiques.
When are you going back to Singapore?
I hope I can get back in. That's a question. Singapore doesn't like foreign journalists who don't toe the line completely, and I think I've departed from the official line on more than one occasion in my New Yorker article. I actually love Singapore. It's a very interesting place, and I'd like to go back soon. And whether I can get in or not is the big question in my mind.
So are you convinced that the leadership in Singapore reads the New Yorker?
Oh, the leadership in Singapore doesn't miss anything. You know, if you criticize Singapore and, I don't know, the Idaho Statesman or something, and your name's going to be on the immigration list at the Singapore airport.
So I guess you'll find out when you try to get back in if your name's on the list or not.
Well, I think I'll make a couple discreet queries before I go back in.
Right, right. Well, Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Stan Sesser is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and in the current edition, he has a piece about Singapore. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.